This podcast was recorded before the announcement of the death of the prominent Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Many of the topics and themes we discuss in this podcast will of course be subject to change as events unfold. However, in the meantime, we will be continually reporting on the implications of this death just a few weeks before the presidential election.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Sibylline Insights. I'm Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence, and today I'm delighted to be joined by members of our Europe and Eurasia desk. We've got Alexander Lord and we have Leila Guest. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
So we've heard about the year of elections. We've already had some quite impactive polling throughout January, and next month, as we're recording this, mid-March, we have another key election, although maybe somewhat more of a foregone conclusion. I am, of course, talking about the Russian election. Alex, just take us through, you know, how this election is going to work. I understand, you know, it's over maybe several days, and you know how you think it might pan out.
Absolutely. So, we have the Russian presidential elections coming up, and of course, these are one of the most important elections in the Eurasian region. But we all know who's already going to win, and probably by quite a margin if the Kremlin has any control over it, which of course they do. So the election is a highly choreographed opportunity for the Kremlin to consolidate its control, project democratic legitimacy, and of course, in the shadow of the war, also potentially have an opportunity to present this as a semi-referendum on the war. Support for President Putin could well be perceived and at least projected as support for the special military operation in Ukraine. So the voting is going to take place between the 15th and the 17th of March. But like I said, foregone conclusion. There's been a lot of preparation already ahead of the vote, including curtailing and limiting the number of individuals that could even put their name forward to become a candidate. And we've seen a number of very prominent individuals being rejected by the Central European Electoral Commission.
A couple of weeks ago, actually, Leila, we had Sir Laurie Bristow on the podcast, and he described this as an election with one candidate and one voter. However, how is this playing out inside Russia? Alex just alluded to the fact that Navalny perhaps isn't this lauded figure inside Russia as he may be internationally. What are we seeing on the ground, particularly in, you know, the urban centres such as Moscow and St. Petersburg?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the recent weeks and months, we've seen protests by the wives of men that have been mobilised. Recently, there was one in Moscow that took place, and lots of journalists were arrested on the ground for covering this. So this is something that we were covering within our Ukraine report, and we essentially assessed that these arrests of the journalists were in a way to enable them to not have this platform anymore. And interestingly, I wanted to jump off of what Alex had said about candidates that are running or not running in this instance. There's been at least two Kremlin critics and anti-war candidates that were interested and tried to run and put their name forward. So these are Boris Nadezhdin and Yekaterina Dunsova, and they were both barred from participating in the race because we assess that this war is not going to end soon. It's not something that Putin wants to end soon. So by banning these candidates, again, this is something Putin doesn't want to do and can't do is end the war. So it takes away that option for people, for the Russian voters.
And are these two candidates still alive? Have they not been thrown out of a window yet, or they've just been simply barred from participating?
Yes, they've just been barred from participating.
And, you know, we were talking before we started recording about the other restrictive measures that have been put in place. You said about the journalists getting arrested, candidates being barred from the same old playbook. But as we enter, you know, as Putin enters the kind of age of tech, we're seeing restrictions placed on private networks, virtual private networks as well, ostensibly to have more control over the internet.
Absolutely. So this was news over the last few weeks. A prominent Russian NGO allied with the Kremlin stated the possibility of a ban of major VPNs in Russia ahead of the election, beginning potentially the 1st of March. Those comments were rolled back somewhat. However, this does reflect the broader direction of travel, I think, in which Russia has been going. You do mention that Putin is very much, his regime is very much in the technological age. And I think since the installation of Prime Minister Mishustin, the technocratic government head, the Kremlin has very much embraced the technological advantages to the modern world. And its ability and its attempt to control as much of it as possible. We have seen in Russia a particular type of digital authoritarianism, you could describe it. And of course, ahead of the election, this is going to become increasingly important. That's why I think the telecoms watchdog is discussing potential VPN bans. We've already seen temporary bans and temporary outages on VPNs, but also other telecommunication platforms, for example, WhatsApp, Telegram. Telegram, of course, extraordinarily important in the Russian-speaking world. So there are various attempts by the Kremlin to control as much as they can. This is part of a wider strategy, I think, which the Russians are trying to move forward on around the concept of digital sovereignty, the so-called sovereign internet concept, which the Kremlin has been trying to push towards. Essentially, the aim is to cut off, if possible, Russia from the World Wide Web, akin to the Great Chinese Firewall, of course. And that is, of course, the great the goal. But the Russians, in contrast to the Chinese, have had a significant technological issues that have prevented them from making major progress in that direction. There is still a lot of problems. The Russian system itself is still reliant on the cloud, for example, which is, of course, very much interconnected with the World Wide Web, which means cutting off will be difficult.
And Leila, going on from the VPN topic, I mean, one assumes that part of the rationale behind this VPN ban is to mitigate any accesses to international news websites, for example, by folks in Russia. I know we've seen that in play before in other parts of the world. But is there anyone left in Russia, you know, any significant center of population in Russia that is liberal and would actually want to access these international sites, or are they all now exiled? Does Putin actually, even if he were to exercise his authority in this way, would he win anyway? Because the folks that are left in Russia, you know, for Putin, I don't know. What are we seeing on the ground?
I think we have to remember that Putin does still enjoy a lot of popularity, which might sound, you know, if we're looking in from a Western perspective, it might sound, you know, strange or as if everything is horse-fight. But no, he still does enjoy a considerable amount of popularity within Russian audiences, and primarily those would be older people that primarily watch state media. A lot of young Russians have left, especially those that didn't want to be mobilized or were fearing the consequences of still staying there. The most important thing is these news outlets, you know, they provide information that isn't accessible within Russia, so the Kremlin and the authorities want to restrict this because for them they can't control this narrative, but they can do things such as blocking it, but they can't necessarily stop the sentiment among people. It's interesting in the sense we've seen polls from November 2023 that mobilization, if another round was to be called, would be deeply unpopular. Around 58% of Russians think this, and about 74% of Russians, I believe, would agree with Putin stopping the war tomorrow. Wow. So these are big figures, and I think highly indicative of the mood in Russia. Of course, with polling, you can't necessarily always trust it, but it does give an insight into how the mood is like ahead of the elections.
And wow, those are staggering numbers. So will Mr. Putin stop the war tomorrow, should he win the election? What effect will his, I think we're saying, inevitable victory have on the context of the war? Will it just maintain the status quo, or will this be a line in the sand where Putin maybe has a different policy direction in terms of the war?
I think, as always, elections do provide the newly elected or re-elected leader with a certain amount of political capital to spend in the coming 6 to 12 months. I think Putin, by and large, is a very, very cautious politician, and this is, to many, in many instances, a part of his success over the last 20 years. And he does retain, as Leila mentioned, widespread popularity. But of course, he has to be careful to marshal that support and not alienate it. And we've already seen, as Leila alluded to, throughout this war, since the full-scale invasion, various policies which have had a significant impact on support. Mobilization is the key one. We've seen, you know, tens of thousands, particularly in the IT sector, actually, and this is compounding the issues that the sovereign internet concept has, so many IT specialists, hundreds of thousands left after the first wave of the mobilization. These are populations and demographics which the Kremlin needs to be concerned about, and they are. Despite the widespread authoritarian mechanisms in place, and indeed the genuine support amongst various demographics, the Kremlin is concerned and does remain fairly cautious, including in its prosecution of the war, in terms of its impact on domestic audiences. To that extent, I think we're still likely to see the Kremlin prioritize indirect mobilization, recruiting convicts, recruiting foreign migrants. This is a particular area which we're seeing a proliferation of recently, reports of some 15,000 Nepali troops, for example. These are quite large numbers when one considers, you know, the various pools of foreign labor that the Russians could tap. So I think the Kremlin is likely to prioritize that rather than mobilizing formally, you know, potentially middle-class young people who have potentially more affluent parents in Moscow, St. Petersburg, where the more liberal demographics tend to be concentrated.
And Leila, a few questions to go. We talked about protests in the streets, arresting of journalists, etc. And before we move on to kind of the more strategic business outcomes, in the run-up to the election, aside from the comms blackouts and the usual stuff that we see, what are we expecting? Are we expecting a different security landscape going up to the election than we normally have in terms of civil unrest, be that planned or ad hoc? What are we likely to see over the next 4 weeks?
I reckon what we're likely to see is the authorities announcing bans on the hosting of rallies and protests across, not even just for March, but I reckon even further into the future than that. So in Leningrad Oblast, where St. Petersburg is, this is Putin's home city, they have banned rallies and protests until May, citing terror threats and other provocations. So one can imagine potentially what these other provocations may be. Those could be anti-war rallies, which, if went ahead, or anti-Putin rallies as well, for that matter, if those went ahead, it would be very damaging to Putin's campaign because this is his home city. I reckon we could see definitely other announcements, say in Moscow and other major cities as well. So that's one thing that I think we will definitely expect in the coming weeks.
And in terms of the business environment, are we likely to see any changes in the ability to operate in Russia? Have we seen any, as the war has gone on, have we seen any indications that companies are moving back in? Will this alter the dial for organizations, businesses, such as that of our clients?
I think the primary consideration to draw is relating to the increasing clampdown on tech and communications. Obviously, when you're operating in Russia, one always has to be aware of a certain amount of surveillance, and almost all communications should be considered compromised when you're in Russia to a varying extent. The current legislation that's being considered, the possible bans on VPNs, the move towards internet sovereignty, digital sovereignty, all of this is empowering the FSB to have increased control and ability to access which in other jurisdictions would be unaccessible information. And of course, when operating in Russia, this is a concern. Domestic security is the single most important concern for the Kremlin. The Kremlin already has significant reach, and this reach is increasing. Domestic security, as I said, is the most important consideration, and this is only going to worsen, I think, going forward. The technology available to the Kremlin is increasing. You know, we're seeing this in the West, we're seeing this in Russia. AI, etc. All of these tools are being utilized and harnessed in this authoritarian space. And I think that's going to have a key knock-on impact on the business environment.
So absolutely fascinating. And before we leave Russia, Leila, maybe not the fairest of questions, because I know you two are avid Russia watchers. I know you both probably go to bed at night thinking about Soviet politics and reading Tolstoy. However, we're not all Russia watchers. And by the sounds of it, nothing much is going to change after Putin will almost certainly win the election and carry on being in power. So why should we care about it? Why should we tune into all the wonderful webinars and reports that we're going to write about it? And why should we care about this election, which is, from what I can see, assuring a foregone conclusion?
Correct. We can assess that Putin will win, and by a good margin as well. There's only four candidates in this election, and those are just going to be sparring partners from, you know, Russia's carefully selected opposition to compete within these campaigns. But what I think is the most important thing to take away from our reporting coming out in a few weeks, the special webinar and also a special report that we'll do on this matter, is the real power dynamic in the Kremlin. How does this work? Because this is something that often outsiders might consider it's just Putin in the Kremlin making all these decisions. But in reality, the power structure is much deeper than that. And I think that's where the real interest will lie. And this is something we'd like to give people more clarity about.
The real power structure is tantalizing. Sounds like a film. But for now, we shall leave Russia. But before we finish this episode of Civline Insights, we've had another recent election in Azerbaijan, which has also, as it turned out, gone to a candidate that everyone expected to win by quite a significant margin. Alex, tell me a little bit about what just happened in Azerbaijan and why it matters and why we should care.
Absolutely. So the recent election in Azerbaijan, it's a small South Caucasian country bordering Iran, Russia and Armenia. So a pretty hot part of the world over the recent years. The incumbent president, Ilham Aliyev, has retained his vice-like grip over the country. 92%, no less, of the vote was cast in his favour. Of course, this was expected. This is amongst the least fair and least free elections in the world. And the Aliyev clan have retained, like I said, a vice-like grip over Azerbaijani politics since the dissolution of the Soviet Union in the 90s. This is unlikely to change anytime soon. The president, interestingly, called this election early. The election was due to happen in 2025. He called it early in February. Why? It's a good question. We've discussed this as to why the reasoning behind this, considering the authoritarian nature of the country, his grip over the country. I think this is part of a consolidation of his victory in Nagorno-Karabakh. So we've seen last year the 24-hour operation to essentially retake the previously ethnic Armenian-controlled region. Nagorno-Karabakh, of course, has been a continual hotbed of conflict since the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and Azerbaijan is now in control of the entirety of the region. So in many instances, it's a victory campaign. However, I think there is also elements of the campaign giving us an indication as to where Baku thinks the conflict might well go. And we saw a particular uptick in revanchist claims and rhetoric during the campaign, claiming southern Armenia is a part of Azerbaijan. So we could well be seeing this election teeing up further efforts by Azerbaijan to force Armenia to agree to some concessions. Both countries are in the process of trying to work towards a peace agreement, but it's still quite a way off, and there is still a lot at stake here, I think. So while much of that revanchist sentiment could well have been aimed at his domestic audience, his electorate, I think there's an element here that he's wanting to ramp up the pressure on Armenia, of course, renewing the prospect of a resumption of conflict. So this election, while a foregone conclusion, can tell us a little bit as to where Baku thinks the conflict may well be going over the next.
Of course, there's been over 50 conflicts, or active conflicts around the world at the moment. I think, you know, in some quarters, this particular conflict underreported, but certainly not at Sibylline, keeping a keen eye on it. And the election itself, the outcomes later, we have written some reporting on this, have we not?
Yes, we released reporting on this ahead of the election, and we detailed the impact that this would have on NGOs, opposition media within the country ahead of the election and also in the coming months as well. We also analysed whether Western investment will stay at a similar level or whether it will wane on the backdrop of further concerns about another conflict and other measures happening within the country. And we also looked at how this vote will also shape the trajectory of relations with Armenia also.
Fascinating. And of course, to get hold of that recording, reporting, our listeners and viewers can contact us at info@sibylline.co.uk. But for now, Leila, Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for another edition of Sibylline Insights. Please do remember to like and subscribe, and we look forward to welcoming you to the next episode.